Good morning. It is 9 o'clock, so we will begin the Board of Directors meeting of the Eastern Municipal Water District for February 21st, 2024. We always start with our Pledge of Allegiance. I see the Assistant City Manager. I see a couple City Managers and Assistant City Managers. One from Marietta, would you like to lead us in the pledge this morning?
Yes, sir. Would you please all put your right hand over your heart and repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
May I ask the board secretary to read the suggestions for virtual participation and then to do a roll call of the board and legal counsel.
Sure, we'll start off with the roll call first. President Pauly.
Here.
Dr. Corona.
Here.
Dr. Slauson.
Here.
Dr. Armstrong.
Here.
Our legal counsel is present, and Director Record is absent. President Pauly, can you come back to the virtual guidelines, please?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Just give me a moment. Mm-hmm.
President Pauly, I can read the online instructions if you like.
Okay, if you want to do that, that'd be great.
EMWD guidelines for virtual participation in EMWD board meetings. To avoid creating acoustic feedback, please mute all your devices during the meeting unless you are speaking. Before speaking, please unmute your device and turn down the volume of any other devices that are near you and tuned into the meeting. If you have joined by phone and would like to comment on an item, please press star 9 now to let our staff know and wait to be notified. When it is your turn to speak, you will hear a notification asking you to unmute your phone by pressing star 6. If you have joined by computer, you may use the chat feature in Zoom to indicate your desire to speak. When done speaking, please mute your device again. Please participate from a quiet environment so that the board can hear you when you are speaking.
Thank you, April. And then do we have anybody who's indicated they'd like to do public comment for any item not on the agenda this morning?
I believe you have one speaker card from Mr. Holler.
And I believe he has it for an item on the agenda. No? Okay. And in that case, Mr. Holler, thank you. Thank you again for leading us in the pledge this morning.
My pleasure. Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. I'm Ivan Holler, Assistant City Manager for the City of Murrieta. And I'm here on behalf of the city to do something that doesn't happen often enough for those of us in public service, to actually commend your staff for something that, a number of things that they did to help us out. You may be aware that we recently reopened the Murrieta Hot Springs Resort on January 31st. That's a big deal for us. We're really happy to have that Hot Springs Resort reopen. I hope you all will get a chance to visit. But they reopened on the 31st, and as sometimes happens with construction, their contractor hadn't quite kept up with some of the schedules and ended up not having water service 2 days before the grand opening. And so we did what we always would do with Eastern, and we appreciate your partnership. We made a few phone calls, and I want to acknowledge those. Some of those folks have called first Roxanne Roundtree, and she was very helpful, as always. And she reached out to a couple of your inspectors, Tim Manning and Troy Vanderwent from Golden State Consultants. And I have to tell you that all of your staff, including the contract inspectors, had just great problem-solving skills. And I want to assure you that we were able to provide water service to the resort and meet all of your standard procedures and safety protocols. So there was no shortcut there, and yet they found a workaround. And then a little bit later, I think the next day, we had another issue that was related to that, and I called Linnea, and she was extremely helpful. She assembled a team right away, got back to us. Those other team members are Armando Arroyo and Alicia Arana, and I want to tell you, they had the same sort of problem-solving mentality and just great customer service. So we're very, very grateful for the assistance of your staff. Mr. Murata, I know that that culture flows from you, so you should be very proud of your staff. And again, I'm here because most of the time you'll have folks that stand up and complain about something. Not too much of this. So we want to make sure that we didn't let this opportunity pass by to commend your staff and you. And we appreciate the partnership that the City of Murrieta has with the Eastern Municipal Water District. Thanks for your time.
I appreciate it very much, and thank you for coming and sharing that with us. We do have a great culture here that is tailored towards solving problems, and I'm glad we're able to solve that one. And I would never suggest how you do things at your city council, but might want to acknowledge them there too, because we do have some good folks. So thank you so much. That will take us to item two this morning, which is a public hearing. I understand, Director Slauson, you have a conflict on the public hearing.
I will be abstaining. My business has done work for the property owner.
Very good. With that, this is the time and place set for a duly noticed public hearing regarding the proposed establishment of Community Facilities District Number 2023-101, McKenna Hills, of the Eastern Municipal Water District, the proposed rate and method of apportionment, and authorizing a CFD to incur bonded indebtedness. I will now declare the public hearing open. I'd like to ask for a staff report. Good morning, Thomas.
Morning, President Pauly, members of the board. EMWD received a signed petition from KB Home Coastal, Inc., requesting that the board consider forming a community facilities district to finance applicable EMWD water and sewer facilities costs in lieu of fees. KB Home is the landowner of certain property located in the Paris area of unincorporated Riverside County on the southwest corner of Walnut Avenue and Sherman Road. On January 17, 2024, the board adopted resolution number 2024-003, declaring its intention to establish CFD number 2023-101, McKenna Hills, and resolution number 2024-004, declaring its intention for the CFD to incur bonded indebtedness not to exceed $10 million, and set today's public hearing. The project is planned for 139 single-family homes. The proposed CFD will be established in compliance with EMWD's comprehensive debt policy, meeting or exceeding all requirements. Annual special taxes within the CFD will have an average effective tax rate of 2% or less at the time of bond sale, and special taxes may be levied at their assigned rate as soon as a parcel is considered developed. The board has received for review a Community Facilities District report for the CFD, which has been prepared by Webb Municipal Finance, LLC, which is hereby entered into the record of this public hearing.
Thank you. I'd like to now ask the board secretary how the public hearing was noticed.
Notice of the public hearing was published on February 13, 2024 in the Press Enterprise, a newspaper circulated within the CFD boundary in accordance with Malheureux Community Facilities Act of 1982.
Very good. If the secretary of the board had received any written protest to the proposal, I'd like to ask her to provide copies, therefore, to the board.
No written protests to the proposal have been received.
Thank you. Since members of the public have been invited to participate in the hearing by phone, I would ask that any members of the public who would like to comment on this item, please do so now. Do we have any?
Not that I'm aware of.
Very good. Seeing no further speakers, I will now declare the public hearing closed. At this time, we are ready to adopt the following resolution, a resolution establishing CFD number 2023-101, McKenna Hills of the Eastern Municipal Water District, authorizing the levy of special taxes and calling election therein, and resolution determining the necessity to incur bond indebtedness within CFD number 2023-101 McKenna Hills and calling an election therein. I will look for a motion and a second to adopt the resolution. Motion by Director Corona.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 3-0 with Director Slauson not participating and Director Record absent. The resolutions that we have just adopted to form CFD number 2023-101 authorize a special tax and call for a bond election within CFD number 2023-101, which is to be held at this time by the Secretary.
All ballots have been cast in connection with the election for Community Facilities District Number 2023-101, McKenna Hills, of Eastern Municipal Water District, and the election has now been closed. The results of said election, which includes the number of votes cast for and against Proposition A, B, and C, was unanimous in favor of all propositions.
Thank you. Having heard the statement from the Secretary certifying the results of the voting on the propositions, I will now entertain a motion to adopt the following resolution. Resolution certifying the results of the February 21st, 2024 special tax and bond elections within CFD number 2023-101, McKenna Hills of the Eastern Municipal Water District.
I'll make that motion.
Second. Moved by Director Armstrong, second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 3-0. Director Slauson not participating and Director Record absent. The resolution is passed. I will now ask the district's legal counsel if there is a necessity for the Secretary to read the proposed ordinance to be voted upon in connection with these proceedings with respect to authorizing a levy of a special tax within CFD 2023-101.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reading of proposed ordinance of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District, acting in its capacity as the legislative body of Community Facilities District Number 2023-101, McKenna Hills of Eastern Municipal Water District, authorizing the levy of a special tax within the district, may be waived since everyone present has a copy of the proposed ordinance or may obtain a copy from the district's website.
Thank you. I will now accept a motion and a second to waive the reading of proposed ordinance and adopt the ordinance.
So moved.
So moved by Director Corona, second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauley?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
Passes 3-0 with Director Slauson not participating and Director Record absent. With that, we will return to the next item on our agenda, which is executive reports. Mr. Mawad, the floor is yours.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. My report is included in your packet. Under new and ongoing items, very pleased to share with the board that on February 8th, we were the recipient of the Cal Desal Inaugural Achievement Award for California Desalination. In fact, we got this incredible acknowledgement during their conference up in Sacramento. We're very fortunate to have Linnea Alexander as well as Greg Kowalski represent EMWD to accept the award. Again, this is their inaugural award, and it highlights the benefits of desalination in the state, both groundwater desalination as well as ocean desalination. Also, I think it highlights the supply reliability of desalination as well as the ability to continue to expand our usage of recycled water and also the strategic partnerships that we've built over the years in advancing our desalination program. So again, I just wanted to congratulate our team who for the last many years and frankly decades has been diligently advancing our desalination effort, and this is an incredible acknowledgement by the Cal Desal Association for our efforts. Next, I wanted to share with the board that last week, I apologize, it was on February 9th, actually, that myself, along with seven general managers, including the general managers of Western Metropolitan Water District of Orange County, MODOC, as well as Foothill, cities of Burbank, city of Pasadena, and others joined in a coalition letter that we submitted to the Metropolitan team to highlight our comments and our perspective on the Climate Adaptation Master Plan for water, specifically the evaluative criteria as well as the time-bound targets. And this is a process that's been undertaken by Metropolitan over the last many months to develop a framework for decision-making going forward on climate adaptation. And our comments were along the lines of emphasizing reliability, resilience, affordability, and adaptability as the four highest ranking criteria, as well as social and environmental co-benefits with secondary criteria or secondary weighting, if you will. We continue to work very closely with Dr. Armstrong on providing our feedback to Metropolitan, and the next task force meetings will be held on February 29th as well as March 18th. Also, we are working with Metropolitan's Camp for Water program manager, Ms. Liz Crossan, who we have invited to come out to speak to this board and provide an update on the entire process to support, and we're currently targeting sometime in April for that presentation by Liz. In addition to working with Ms. Crossan to provide you an update on the Camp for Water, we are also working with other leadership members at Metropolitan to have him come out and present you with updates on timely topics. We're working with Metropolitan's CFO, Catano, who will be coming out to our board meeting on March 20th, provide you an update on the proposed Metropolitan budget and rates that has recently been shared with the Metropolitan board members. There is ongoing conversations about the path forward on those budgets and rates, and I think it will be a timely conversation that Catano will be able to share with this board. In addition, working with the Met leadership, we have arranged for Chair Ortega as well as General Manager Adel Khashkhalil to come out and give you an update on all things Metropolitan, and that presentation has been scheduled for April 17th, and we're also very pleased that both Chair Ortega and Adele will be able to join the board for lunch afterwards. In addition to the presentations that I just mentioned by Metropolitan leadership, Director Armstrong is working with us and the Met team to schedule a tour of the Pure Water SoCal facility. And that tour is specifically going to be geared for our wholesale customers, our wholesale agencies, if you will. So we have been and we will be reaching out to Rancho, Fallbrook, and others to invite them to attend that tour, which will take place on April 11th. Next, under items of interest to the board, wanted to share with you that on February 14th, I had the opportunity, along with our team, to meet with Rancho's general manager and CFO to discuss the wholesale administrative rate that is currently in effect between Eastern and Rancho. And specifically, as you're aware, that rate was originally established back in 1982 at $3 per acre foot. It has not been adjusted over the last 40-some years. So it was a good conversation with the general manager and the CFO. I think there is a consensus that that rate needs to be updated to reflect current conditions. Our finance team did provide several methodologies for consideration. I think there's interest to try to develop a equitable approach to addressing it. And I think we're both committed to working towards an updated administrative rate to be effective by July 1st of this year. So we're going to have follow-on meetings, but I want to let you know that that process is already underway with RCWD. And finally, I wanted to share with you that last Friday, I and Jolene, as well as Pete Evich from Venskoyek, we had the opportunity to meet with Ali D'Agostina, who's the new representative on water issues for Congressman Ruiz. It was a really good discussion. We shared with her our various initiatives on desalinization and our pure water program, which Congressman Ruiz has been a very strong supporter whenever we've requested letters of support. Congressman Ruiz has been very much supportive of our request and our efforts. So it was an opportunity to share with her all things EMWD and our initiative. And when we're back in Washington, D.C. later this year, we'll make a point of continuing to build that relationship. And with that, be happy to answer any questions to the board.
Any questions from board members?
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Mawad. Laura, do you have anything for us this morning?
No, nothing this morning.
All right. Nick?
Thank you.
Good morning, President Pauley. Nothing from me.
Matt?
Good morning. Have a quick one. Coming up in March, Metropolitan is planning their annual Colorado River Aqueduct shutdown. It's currently scheduled for March 5th to the 28th. And this year, they have indicated that we'll be doing the tunnel measurement. That's currently on the schedule for March 14th.
All right. Very good. With that, we will move on to item number four this morning, which is our consent calendar. Do I have any members of the board that would like a separate vote or recuse themselves from the item on the consent calendar? Seeing none, I'll look for a motion.
I'll move it.
Moved by Director Cronus, second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Folley?
Aye.
Director Cronus?
Aye.
Director Slosson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that report passes 4-0. Director Record absent. We will now move on to item five, which is our action calendar. Item A is to approve a memorandum of understanding between the Eastern Municipal Water District and the City of Paris for the transfer of ownership of the City of Paris water and sewer systems. Mr. Mawad.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. As you're aware, about 2 years ago, the City of Paris approached EMWD and requested consideration to transfer their water and sewer system to EMWD. And over the last 2 years, there's been a tremendous amount of effort to mutually work on developing a path forward. We've conducted a very detailed condition assessment on the city's water and sewer system, as well as valuation of the groundwater rights that would be transferred. But beyond that, we've also been working on very detailed efforts, including their customer accounts and their properties that would have to be transferred and the logistics of actually transferring a system. But I'm just incredibly proud of the work that's been done by both our team and the city's team, because I think we're at the point now where we can recommend to you consideration of a MOU that would signal your concurrence with a path forward, as well as approve a work plan. There's still significant amount of work to be done over the next 6 months, working again closely with legal and other folks. There's logistical matters that have to be addressed, but we feel strongly that over the next 6 months we'll be able to take care of that. So I'm just very, again, very appreciative of the work that's been done, very glad we are at the point where we can make this recommendation. I do want to acknowledge the city manager who's here with us today. Clara Miramontes has been an incredible force behind working with us to advance this effort, as well as the deputy city manager, Ernie Reyna, who's here as well. So both of them have been great partners to EMWD. I did want to spend just a few minutes before I give Clara the opportunity to say a few words. I did want to have Nick come up and maybe share some of the details of the MOU that is in front of you for consideration.
Thank you, Joe. Actually, I don't have that much more to share than what Joe has presented to you. The MOU that's before you today is a commitment on the part of EMWD and the City of Paris to consolidate the systems, subject to the execution of the work plan. And as Joe says, that, you know, this MOU is the culmination of a number of years of hard, diligent work on the part of EMWD and the city, and doing due diligence, condition assessments, really understanding what it's going to take to consolidate the systems. The MOU does set forth the terms, conditions, and the financial obligations for the consolidation, which we've worked really hard in developing and presented to the board a number of times previously. The MOU predominantly focuses on the what we're calling the work plan. The MOU is a great, you know, milestone to have achieved and hopefully receive board approval for at this point in time. But beyond that, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done in the areas of operations and maintenance, engineering, developing maps, GIS systems, finance, customer service, and billing. That's going to be a big one, and we're working closely with the city right now in gathering all that information and data and understanding how that can be integrated and transitioned over to EMWD. There's regulatory and permitting requirements that need to be consolidated and integrated, purchasing and contracts information, safety, security, and risk management. Easton does set a very high bar in that area, so we need to understand how we integrate the systems and ensure that we meet the standards that we've set in place for safety, security, and risk. And then there's a lot of legal requirements and issues to be fleshed out. And as important as everything else, there is a community outreach and communications plan, which April Cody and her team are coordinating with the city in developing. So there's a lot of work to be done. Even at the end of this, and with the potential consolidation with the two systems, we do envision for that to occur, that there will be a number of other transfer agreements that will need to be executed for the transfer of real property, facilities, easements, right away, the water rights. So there's a lot of details to be identified and legal vehicles to be put in place to allow all that to happen effectively. And as Joe said, well, there's a lot of work to be done. As we get into it, we'll understand better, you know, the details of what that's going to take. But we have set ourselves a collective goal of accomplishing this within about 6 months. And the entire team from the city to EMWD have committed to work together cooperatively to ensure that we get this done within that six-month time frame. So with that and with the board's pleasure, I would like to give Claire an opportunity to say a few words unless you have any questions for me yet.
I just had a quick one, and I know the answer, but just to put it on the record, there will be no employee transfers when this happens, correct?
Correct. There are no city employees. They contract that work out, so there's no city employees that we would be transferring to Eastern. They do have contract services in place right now, and that's part of what we're looking at. We may want to tap those contracts for a short period of time or on an as-needed basis just to ensure we get through, you know, any issues or gaps that are identified as we consolidate the systems.
Very good. With that, I'd love to have the city manager come up and say a few words. Thank you and welcome. Thank you for being here this morning.
Thank you. Good morning, President Pauly and board members. I am Clara Mira Montes, and I am city manager with the City of Paris. And with me today, I have our deputy city manager, Ernie Reyna. I'm here on behalf of the City of Paris to express our full support for this item. As Mr. Mawad mentioned, we've been working between the City of Paris and EMWD for the past 2 years, and we are very excited to finally reach this milestone today. We've been, and thank you to the wonderful leadership and guidance of Mr. Mawad and his staff, we've been able to get through this process and get to where we are here today. We do believe, and we know that this is a really exciting. We believe this is in the best interest of the residents of the City of Paris, and we are looking forward to and committed to. And thank you to your support and our electeds and our City Council support. We are committed and ready to move forward on the next steps to bring this consolidation to fruition as soon as we can within the next 6 months or so. So, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Any questions? Director Armstrong?
What, more just comments. Director Slauson and I sit on the ad hoc committee, so we've been participating in this and following it for the last couple of years. And I just want to say, you know, just a compliment to our staff and to the city staff for all the effort that they've put into this. It's not an easy thing to do, and it's a whole lot of work and a lot of investigation, and you guys have done just a fantastic, tremendous job. And I also compliment the city on its public agency leadership. It's not, I don't think it's an easy thing for an agency to look at their services and say, you know, what's really in the best going forward? What worked good in the past, but what's the best interest for our citizens going forward? I think it's a brave step to look for someone else to take over a utility like this. But I think we're in a position to do a great job with it, and I think to date it's been great results, so I support this.
I would add, just it's always commendable, I think, when two public agencies can work together to find a common ground, something that benefits all the residents, all of ours, yours, and it just saves everyone time, money, and service, provides a good service. So thank you for your work on it.
Okay, thank you. There's no further questions or discussions. I will look for
President Pauly, if I can just maybe have Claire add one more piece of information.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mawad. I forgot to mention the City of Paris Council did approve the very similar MOU, same MOU, at our last week's council meeting. So thank you again for your time.
Thank you for that. Yes. All right. Would our ad hoc committee members like to make a motion? Motion by Director Slauson.
Second.
Second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Dr. Croner?
Aye.
Dr. Slauson?
Aye.
Dr. Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0. Director Record absent. Thank you again for being here. Always a pleasure. We will move on to item B, which is to approve and authorize a water supply assessment for the villages of Lakeview. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, President Pauly and members of the board.
So yeah, we have another water supply assessment for your consideration today. This one is for the villages of Lakeview. And so starting as usual with just a refresher on the background for these documents, we prepare water supply assessments at the request of a land use agency as part of the CEQA process. So this requirement comes into play when a project meets specific size thresholds. In this case, it's going to be that it's a residential development with greater than 500 units. And a water supply assessment is, the purpose is in the name. It's an evaluation of whether our water supplies are expected to be sufficient to meet a proposed project's demands. And in our analysis, we are allowed to reference the results of our most recent urban water management plan. So looking at the villages of Lakeview, this project is a project that we've actually looked at in two previous WSAs, most recently in 2013. And this project is going to consist of roughly just a bit over 8,700 dwelling units, along with a range of CII water uses. So for example, there's going to be some schools and parks, as well as land that's going into conservation. The project is located on a roughly 4-mile stretch of Ramona Expressway, which you can see on the figure on this slide here. It starts roughly between where Lakeview Avenue is and goes all the way out, a little bit past Bridge Street. And the lead agency that requested this WSA was Riverside County. So looking at the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan, when we looked at our service area, the parcels that are going to be part of this project had a range of land uses that we were tracking. We anticipated the demand from those parcels to be 4,164 acre feet annually. Once we got the information from the developer and the land use agency for what they're currently proposing on this project, the demand estimate came out to about 70 acre feet less than that, 4,090 acre feet. So we are generally consistent, obviously some little tweaks here and there in terms of the land uses, but in terms of the overall demand, we are 70 acre feet. And then just want to provide this summary of where we are at in aggregate since the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan. So looking at all the projects that have come in for a water supply assessment since we approved that UWMP, we are a little bit over on a parcel basis what we expected in the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan. But we did account for this. We know that land use changes are going to happen in our service area given that we are quite far from build-out. And so when we put together our 2020 Urban Water Management Plan, we did have a buffer in there to account for land use changes, which I'll go over in a couple slides. And also just want to note that we will account for all of these changes in total when we do our next Urban Water Management Plan. And as I said, this project's actually under for their parcel, so they're actually helping this. So looking at the buffer, what we did, again, to account for the potential for land use changes is we did our demand projections with an assumption that the demands would be about 15% higher than what we are actually seeing in terms of the land use, the water use in our service area. And so what that looks like is you can see the green bars on this graph show the projected growth in our service area, the actual projected water use based on the water use efficiency requirements and what we're seeing actually happen. And then we have that light blue bar that's showing the growth in demand that we're seeing in the WSA since the 2020 Urban Water Management Plan. So you can see we're still well below the blue bar, which shows the total demand projection, or the blue line that shows the total demand projection in our Urban Water Management Plan. And as I mentioned, this project actually reduces the size of that bar a little bit. So we are recommending the approval of this WSA. And then I did want to give some additional context for Metropolitan, since they are our supplier of imported water. When we do our urban water management plan, we coordinate with Metropolitan, and they coordinate with all their member agencies to understand their demands in order to complete their urban water management plan. So when we look at Met's urban water management plan, our service area growth is included in their demand projections. And so as you can see in this graph here, Metropolitan's urban water management plan shows a surplus supply capability both in normal years, you can see between the dark blue and the light blue bars, as well as in a five dry year drought hydrology. And so with that, the recommendation is to approve and authorize the WSA for the villages of Lakeview, and I would be happy to answer your questions.
Gordon, if I could maybe just add one more item. Separate from this item being considered by the board this morning, we are bringing forward an informational item that discusses land use and overall land use within the district as it relates to water supply assessments and our efforts to make sure that we're always not only current with the anticipated changes that are occurring within our area, but also able to continue to commit to supplying water to the development. I know there was a recent question, I believe, raised by Director Corona about some of the densification that we've seen over the years. This doesn't apply to this particular project, but overall, we wanted to share additional information. In fact, that item will be brought forward this week. In fact, tomorrow at the Operations and Engineering Committee. So I just want to give you a heads up that there's a separate informational item that looks overall on the issue of land use tracking integration into our water use planning.
Any other questions?
Well, I guess I just have a question. One, do we have to revise the urban water management plan when Fallbrook, when we change our boundary to include Fallbrook?
Yeah, so what we'll have to do is we don't have to go back and change our 2020 urban water management plan, but when we do our next one for 2025, then we will need to make changes to our projections and account for the demand that Fallbrook will have on our system.
Okay, then a kind of a general question. What do you do when a city adopts a general plan and zoning mm-hmm. ordinance that really allows for anything from commercial to apartments to on the same zoning?
Yeah, so we have a mixed use, a land use category that we can apply, and it's a pretty, the land use, the demand factors for land use are pretty conservative, and so what we kind of try to do is we figure out what the most intense water use would be for, you know, kind of the more, you know, undefined land uses, if you will. And so we try to keep our projections conservative in that regard.
Okay. All right. I just imagining how it's done. Okay. Thank mm-hmm. you. No, I think this is great. We looked at this at engineering committee.
All right. Before we vote, April, I know this project had lots of public interest out there. I just want to double check, make sure we have no public speakers on this item.
I am not aware of any speakers.
Very good. With that, I will look for a motion in a second. Motion by Director Slauson. Second by Director Corona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly.
Aye.
Director Corona.
Aye.
Director Slauson.
Aye.
Director Armstrong.
Aye.
Passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Thank you, Gordon, for a great presentation.
Thank you.
We'll go on to item C, which is to adopt a proposed resolution by the Board of Directors of the Eastern Municipal Water District authorizing the declaration of surplus property for the Sun City Tank Site, assessor parcel number 336-160-003 and 336-160-004. Chris, good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. So, as President Pauly mentioned, staff are recommending the surplus of two unused district parcels today. The Sun City tank site is located, or indicated by the star on screen. This is in the city of Menifee on the west side of I-215 with McCall Boulevard as the northern bound and Newport Road on the southern boundary. So the site is made up of four assessor parcel numbers, and those parcels total 58.5 acres. And the district acquired this site in 1962, so more than 60 years ago. The image on screen is an aerial view of the Sun City tank site. The existing tank pad, noted by the small cylinder, kind of on the northern portion, as well as the tank pad, They utilize approximately 1 acre of land. The two primary drivers for staff recommendation to surplus the subject property are Eastern has received complaints from area residents regarding unauthorized use of the property, and the development community has expressed interest in acquiring a portion of the tank site. We'll focus in on the northern portion of the Sun City tank site. It is 21.3 acres. We have the 1 million gallon tank on that site, and that supplies the 1627 pressure zone. So staff do recommend retaining the northerly parcels for continued access as well as future expansion. In December of 2022, staff completed a lot line adjustment that expanded the southerly parcels and shrunk the largest northerly parcel. This land is rocky and rugged, and the southerly lot lines were moved north to the ridgeline of the hill. And this natural boundary maximizes the alternative use of the southern parcels and minimizes the district's complications for ongoing maintenance. We have before and after pictures of the lot line adjustment there on screen. Staff are able to carry out property boundary changes to improve property marketability, such as a lot line adjustment, per the real estate policy principles that were approved by the board in January of 2014. And I'll cover a few of those in a subsequent slide. Looking at the southerly parcels, the two are comprised of 37.2 acres. There are multiple large open areas that create a firebreak between district property and the residences to the south. This maintained area costs the district roughly $5,000 per year between contractor and our own staff time to manage. As previously mentioned, the residents on the southern boundary have complained about unauthorized use and access, and this primarily consists of individuals establishing encampments on the eastern boundary near I-215. The image on the right-hand side of the screen shows that a majority of the property is zoned low-density residential, which staff believe make it prime for development. The Board of Directors approved 9 policy principles for real estate asset management in which staff utilize from acquisition to disposition of property. 2 of the 9 policy principles are on screen, with number 8 stating that the district will evaluate timing of potential property disposition on a regular basis, which staff have done with this particular case. And number 9 allows staff to enhance the value of district property by making additional improvements or entitlements up to and including lot line adjustments or zoning changes. So staff determined that carrying out a lot line adjustment for the subject property would add value to the marketplace. Next, covering our process to dispose of surplus property, there are 2 primary drivers for these requests coming into real property, one being internal. So we have operation staff suggesting there are challenges with maintaining the property or there's some sort of risk in continuing to keep the property, as well as the public. So we've had external parties express interest in acquiring this property. And real property staff will request internal stakeholder review and approval for surplus land. The internal stakeholders consist of 9 department directors, and they determine if there's any future need for the property for CIP projects or used by operational staff. Those properties that make it through the department director review and evaluation are then advanced to the real estate enterprise team for consideration. The real estate enterprise team consists of most department directors as well as senior executive staff, and they provide the final approval or rejection of potential surplus property before presenting to the board, as we're doing today. The California Surplus Lands Act regulates the process by which jurisdictions in the state dispose of land. Eastern is subject to the California Surplus Lands Act, and the California Department of Housing and Community Development have taken a much more active role in monitoring agency compliance with the Surplus Lands Act. The Act requires formal action by the board to declare property owned by the district as either surplus land or exempt surplus land. And the parcels discussed today do not fall under any potential exemptions. Therefore, we must follow the full California HCD process to surplus the property. The California HCD surplus process begins with the board declaring the property as surplus through resolution. We will advertise the property for 60 days with agencies registered with Housing and Community Development. So those include cities, school districts, builders of affordable housing, and the list is quite extensive. If one of those agencies responds during the 60-day period, EMWD and that agency will enter into a 90-day negotiation period, and at that time we would obtain an appraisal for the property. If multiple agencies respond, priority will be given to the agencies looking to build affordable housing. If there's no agreement, after that 90-day period, EMWD can publicly market that property. So staff are not recommending a sale of this property. We will, once we receive offers from the agencies or public, we'll come back to the board for authorization of selling the property. So this is just the first step. And with that, the recommendation is to adopt the resolution declaring assessor parcel numbers 336-160-003 and 004 as non-exempt surplus land, as well as authorizing the general manager to take necessary actions to effectuate the resolution and dispose of the surplus lands in compliance with the Surplus Land Act. With that, happy to take any questions the board may have.
Questions, Director Slauson?
Yeah, I do have a question. We talked at committee level, we talked about how if it went to a private sale, a developer would look at, like, do a lotting study, see how many lots they thought they could get. Did we discuss the zoning?
Like a zoning change or the existing?
That's the question. I mean, would you market it as potentially R5?
Well, so most of the property is currently zoned as low-density residential. So I think it's 7,200-square-foot lot. So the remaining northerly portion of that southerly parcel or southerly parcels would likely remain as hillside. So they would be looking to develop the southern portion of the southern parcels, if that makes sense.
Okay. All right, then a developer would normally want an escrow, a long enough escrow to get an entitlement. Is that something the district would consider?
That would be one of the evaluation
probably
factors,
okay.
Right?
I just curious. Okay. Now, this looks fine.
So, question?
Yeah, I guess just kind of piggybacking on what Dave had to say. So we're not really discussing that all that kind of stuff right now. This all comes later as far as when, if we sold privately, if it, you know, offers were going back and forth, and that's when we would start discussing, you know, the terms and things like that. So
exactly, right.
Okay. I kind of consider, I doubt that they're going to leave it at 7,200 square foot lots. I mean, it's the side of a hill, and they might be thinking of something else, but anyway. Okay.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what sort of proposals we receive from, you know, agencies, and if that doesn't work out from the private market.
Yeah, and I just wanted to just clarify that once we have, if the board chooses to declare this surplus, as we are recommending, and once we have proposals from public agencies or otherwise, we will evaluate those proposals. We'll bring them back. Before we bring them back to the board, we'll bring them back to committee. We'll discuss it in committee, get feedback, get direction, how to proceed, and then take that appropriate next step based on committee direction as well.
Chris, one thing that caught my ear here that's really not germane to the item, but it sounds like we have a homeless issue on this piece of property. Is that correct?
It's popped up a few times. It hasn't within, I would say, the last 6 to 12 months. I suspect Menifee police are probably responding.
That always just leads me to what our liability issues is when we have people on our property that shouldn't be there. So I want to make sure that that is maintained.
And we do have that issue arise on occasion, President Pauly, not just on this property, but other properties. We have, as you know, a number of property holdings. So yes. We have security that will inspect the properties on a regular schedule. And then when we do get notified or observe encampments, we'll work with the local authorities to deal with it. But it is an issue. It requires time and resources, and there's also risk whenever you have those kind of conditions arise at a vacant property.
But we post no trespassing on our property. So okay, I just want to become aware of liability issues of unwelcome visitors on our property. So.
Director Armstrong, did you have a question? Or?
No question. Okay. Item.
Moved by Director Armstrong.
Second by Director Crona. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. Thank you, Chris. Great presentation. We will move on to item D, which is to adopt a proposed resolution adjusting the boundaries of Division 2 of the Eastern Municipal Water District to include the service area of the Fallbrook Public Utilities District. Gordon, you're back for the second presentation of the day. I don't know if that qualifies as overtime, but the floor is yours.
So President Pai, I was just going to quickly introduce this item in terms of, as you're aware, as of January 1st this year, Fallbrook Public Utilities District is a wholesale customer of EMWD per the LAFCO action. At the time when we asked the board to authorize that change, this board requested that we come back as staff with a plan going forward that addresses the governance issue. And that's exactly what we've done. We have a well-thought-out, well-laid-out plan that Gordon is going to share with you that addresses the issue of governance and ultimately the redistricting that is triggered by this. With that, I'll turn it over to Gordon.
All right. Thank you, Joe, for the intro. And, I'll jump right into this presentation. So starting with some of the background, I know Joe covered a little bit of this, but and obviously this has been an issue that we've discussed in many prior meetings. But in March of 2020, Fallbrook Public Utility District and Rainbow Municipal Water District submitted applications to San Diego LAFCO proposing a reorganization where that they would receive their wholesale water service from us instead of the San Diego County Water Authority. That kicked off a number of studies and analysis, by LAFCO, by us, Water Authority. And so that was about a three-year process that culminated in June of 2023 with a conditional approval of this reorganization by San Diego LAFCO. And that was followed in November by approval by public vote within the service areas of Fallbrook and Rainbow. And how that kind of concluded is in December of 2023, we have the settlement agreement between Fallbrook, Rainbow, and the County Water Authority come into place. And then San Diego LAFCO was able to issue a certificate of completion for Fallbrook right away. And then Rainbow is anticipated to follow in about a year. They're still waiting on some infrastructure improvements that they need to complete before LAFCO can issue that certificate. And so just on the map here, you see in blue the EMWD service area prior to the reorganization, with Fallbrook service area in the green. As Joe mentioned, they are now a wholesale customer of Eastern, and then Rainbow is that gray polygon just to the east of Fallbrook, and that is what is pending and probably coming in about a year. So with Fallbrook being now receiving their wholesale water service from Eastern, they've been annexed into our territory. And if you look at Division 20 of the Water Code, which is the Municipal Water District Act of, or Law of 1911, that refers us to Elections Code, which notes that when a territory gets annexed to the district, the board needs to, at some point, designate by resolution which division that the newly annexed territory would become a part of. And so based on, as Joe alluded to, our discussion at prior board meetings, as well as just looking at geographic proximity, the resolution that we're bringing forth for your consideration today is proposing that Fallbrook be attached to Division 2 based on geographic proximity. And so again, we have that mapped out for you on this slide here, with Division 2 representing the southern area of our service area prior to the reorganization, and then Fallbrook in that hatched purple. So proposing that we attach it to Division 2. Again, Rainbow will follow at a later date, and we'll have to look at this. So what changes with the addition of Fallbrook to our service area? So when we add Fallbrook, that increases our population by about 35,000 people. And that will make, with the attachment to Division 2, that will make Division 2 the largest of our divisions. And that actually puts us about 17% above an ideal division where the population is exactly equal in each division. Division 4 will remain our smallest division, and they're going to be 8% below ideal. And so you'll notice that gives us a spread of about 25% between our largest and smallest division, and the generally accepted deviation is just 10%. And so in consultation with legal counsel, there is a recommendation that concurrent to the attachment of Fallbrook to Division 2 that we commence a redistricting process so that we can rebalance those populations and, again, reduce that spread a little bit. And then there is one provision that will be impacting this process, which is that under the Elections Code, we cannot change the division boundaries in the 180 days preceding an election. And given that this process will involve multiple public hearings as well as workshops, we anticipate that we will not be meeting that timeline, so we won't be able to finalize the redistricting until after the November election. It doesn't mean that we can't work on it, but we cannot actually finalize this process. And so that's that need for redistricting is there, and I just want to summarize that with some of the numbers that we've been talking about with some tables. So the top table shows the division populations as they existed prior to the reorganization as of February 2022, which was when we did our last redistricting process. So you'll see that Division 4 obviously was the smallest division then and will be the smallest division now. Previously, Division 3 was our largest division. You'll see that the spread is under 10%. And we did have Divisions 1 and 4 smaller as under the last redistricting process because those were the divisions where we expected the most growth to occur. And so the thought was that, as we go, until the next census, that it would keep our population relatively balanced. So now with Fallbrook in the mix, looking back at the redistricting data set that was provided by the Census Bureau, as I mentioned, Division 2, you can see in the table on the bottom there, does, go about, 60, almost 17% above the ideal division population, and there is that 25% spread that you're seeing that I mentioned on my previous slide. So with that, the recommendations that we're bringing for your consideration today, one is to adopt the resolution that attaches Fallbrook Public Utility District to Division 2. And then the concurrent recommendation is that you'll authorize staff to begin the redistricting process so that we can rebalance those populations. And I would be happy to take your questions.
President Pauly, if I can just maybe add one clarification relative to the redistricting process. As Gordon mentioned, we will need to essentially suspend activities 6 months preceding the election. And so what that basically puts us in the first week of May. So although we will be able to initiate the process, do some preparatory work, data analysis, frankly, because as Gordon mentioned, the process also involves a number of public hearings, public meetings, community meetings, and workshops, we will not be able to undertake those efforts starting first week of May. So the process in itself will be suspended to allow the elections to take place in November. Once the election is concluded, we'll resume the process. At that time, we do anticipate that Rainbow will be ready to receive its certification of completion by San Diego LAFCO. So at that time, we may be in front of the board asking for a bit of a change in our redistricting, meaning that we may have to also incorporate the Rainbow population as well. So we'll obviously continue to monitor that effort, but I just want to clarify that point.
Very good. Any questions on this?
Sure, just a point of clarification. So in the interim, Steve doesn't get an extra weighted vote or anything, right?
No, he does not.
Okay, I'll support it.
I'll just talk more, that's all. It's probably worse.
I had one, and just to clarify for the record to legal counsel, there's nothing in the Water Code that says our divisions need to be contiguous. In other words, this will be a little island south of us, but that is legal, correct?
That's correct. The district's organizing statutes allow for non-contiguous configurations of the divisions.
Okay. Director Corona, would you like to move the item? Yes, moved by Director Corona, second by Director Slauson, given his concerns. I'll ask for roll call vote, please.
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Gordon. We will look forward to your redistricting process. I know that's why you went to engineering school. All right, we'll move on to item E, which is to adopt a proposed resolution amending Resolution 5111 of the Eastern Municipal Water Administrative Code as it relates to index adjustments to the Board of Directors' composition for 2024.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the Board. In front of you is a staff recommendation, as indicated in the title, per our admin code and the California Water Code. We look at the CPI index on an annual basis, and as you're aware, we currently use the Riverside County, San Bernardino, Ontario CPI index. And based on that CPI index, for the past year, for the past rolling 12-month period, the CPI, as the board has adopted for the cost of living adjustment for our staff, is 5.3%. But per the admin code and the water code, board compensation adjustment is limited to 5%. So with that, we did reach out to look at other agencies and what other agencies' compensation levels are, as presented in the board letter. You'll see that Eastern ranks towards the bottom of the list relative to board members' compensation, currently at 245. The others, exceed $330 a day. So we believe that it is very much appropriate for this adjustment to take place. That will bring the compensation for day of service from $245 to $258, a maximum impact of $800 a month. For the maximum number of meetings that can be attended. With that, be happy to answer any questions the board may have.
Any questions on this item? None. Look for a motion.
I'll move it.
Director Slauson, second by Director Armstrong. May I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Crumb?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
That passes 4-0 with Director Record absent. I know we will move on to informational items now. I know we have a guest, so why don't we do item A, and then we will take a break before item B. So, Mr. Mawad, you want to introduce our guest for item A?
Yes, thank you, President Pauly. I have the privilege today to present to you Ms. Nina Hawk. Nina is the Bay Delta Initiative Group Manager and the Chief of Bay Delta Resources for the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. In her role, she is responsible for managing the development and implementation of Metropolitan's Bay Delta strategy, including the Bay Delta Initiatives Program. She has also been acting in her role as Metropolitan's representatives on interest and issues such as the Bay Delta Conveyance Program, the voluntary agreements, the sites, reservoir, and major statewide Bay Delta policy issues. Ms. Hawk earned her bachelor's degree in civil and environmental engineering and her master's degree in public administration from San Jose University. With that, Nina, can you hear us?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Welcome.
Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you so much for that introduction and for having me here today. Looking forward to providing you an update, just a general overview of two major items in particular, the Bay Delta Islands and, of course, the Delta Conveyance Project. So we'll go ahead and begin. Next slide. So the Delta Islands in particular are, in fact, real property that Metropolitan owns within the Bay Delta region. So we'll walk through a little bit of history on those islands. And then we'll provide you an update with what we recently shared with the Metropolitan Board, which is a deeper dive in some of the utilization of those islands, the purposes, and strategic analysis, et cetera. And then for Delta Conveyance Project, there have been some key developments over the last few months. So we'll give you an update on the final environmental impact report, along with a touch on bond validation and some critical next steps in that project. Next slide. So just to orient you with the Delta a bit, to the west of this map is the San Francisco Bay Area, so the ocean, and to the east would be the Sierras. But right there in the middle, you'll see highlighted in yellow are four critical islands that Metropolitan owns in the Central Delta. They're Webchack, Bolden, Holland, and Bacon, totaling over 20,000 land acres in the Delta. And I say they're strategically located because you'll see there's blue rivers or blue lines there that indicate the clear pathway of the water that we receive from the Sierras to the Southern California region. So those would be the pathways under which we provide both state water project and any other supplemental water like water transfers, et cetera, that we move through the system and down to the California aqueduct all the way to Southern California. So the location of these islands are critical for that reason, along with a few other things I'll cover today. We did purchase these islands. It's been a while, back in 2006, and we did have some key reasons and strategies for purchasing them then, and so we'll review those, and we'll also talk about what we're doing with them today. So next slide. So at the time, these were the key reasons that were highlighted to the Metropolitan Board for reasons for purchasing them. One, the freshwater conveyance or the pathway that was highlighted in blue on the map right before us was one very key reason. In the event of an emergency or some sort of earthquake or levee failure, to have islands and land that we own and operate and have direct control over to help get those levees back and secured and healthy and resilient allows for us to have a shorter amount of impact in terms of outages for our water supply. So having that direct ownership gives us a real boots on the ground ability to manage for our security of our water supply. It also allows for us to plan with those levees to ensure that they stay nice and strong and are fortified by the latest engineering technology and information from our staff to build and rehab those over the years for continued water supply reliability. The other major reason we purchased these islands at the time was the California Water Fix, which, if you recall, was the twin tunnel project, was slated to go through the Central Delta, which means it would have gone underneath these islands. And so the islands would have been situated in a location that could help for both construction purposes and potentially mitigation for the twin tunnel project. As a reminder, the governor did, in fact, when he came into office, change the project, and so he restated the project to be a single tunnel project, and I'll be covering a little bit more of that later in the presentation. But just so you know, that was one of the main purposes of buying the islands at the time as well. The other reasons are listed there as well, which is fish food enhancement and regulatory flexibility. So what do fish have to do in regulatory flexibility? Well, obviously going through this very, precious and beautiful space in California, it has a lot of aquatic life, which of course is impacted by the movement of water. So as water is moving through the system, as we see changes in that hydrological system, whether it's attributed to climate change or sea level rise, or in fact any movement from exporting water, there'll be an impact to fisheries. And so we do have a direct interest at Metropolitan in ensuring a healthy delta. Because a healthy fish environment, of course, leads to better regulations, which leads to flexibility in moving our water more efficiently to Southern California, costing less for us and also allowing for a better coexistence between the environment and, of course, the beneficial use of water supply. Another reason we purchased them was for subsidence control. In the Delta, because of the type of soil, we have peat moss and other soil types out there, they do have agricultural practices that are taking place day in, day out that are utilizing that land, but naturally those islands in the Delta, not just the ones we own, but all of them, are susceptible to subsidence. And subsidence, of course, is when the land ends up losing some of its elevation, and of course that's going to have an adverse impact to the hydrological nature of the environment as well as the natural environment. And of course, the water supply making its way through. So we want to make sure that subsidence is minimized, and we can do that if we own the islands and have a direct control over land there and be able to practice, controls and innovations that minimize subsidence for those purposes. And of course, ecosystem habitat is key. We want to have a healthy delta. It's also a requirement for mitigation to ensure that habitat is restored and or preserved in the Delta, both for existing projects by other jurisdictions in the region and also for, of course, the continued exportation of water from the Delta. And then most recently, but also something that we were looking at back in the day when we purchased these islands, was carbon credits that could be developed with looking at subsidence control. So actually pairing the two together, looking at innovations where you reduce subsidence and then you're reducing the amount of off-gassing, which is reducing the carbon that is going into the atmosphere, thereby allowing for the ability to have carbon credit development. So that's also a revenue stream. Next slide. So what are the main risks we see in the Delta today? And this is really critical to understand why we do what we do in the Delta. The most important one is probably flood and seismic risks. We know these are natural occurrences and things that are outside of our control. But knowing that if there's a major seismic activity in the Delta or there's a flood event that occurs that's either caused by torrential downpour, atmospheric rivers, or an unforeseen, seismic event, losing those levees and their ability to retain the water back could have catastrophic, impacts to both life and property in the Delta. And there is a whole community in the Delta outside of the natural environment of agricultural interests, along with people that are living there. Majority of the folks that are living in the Delta are from disadvantaged communities, so we're also looking out for the community's well-being and ensuring that they have a healthy and prosperous way to live while we also get to coexist with our water supply reliability. Sea level rise is one that we've been seeing and trending over the last several decades, but is really before us as water managers. So we really have to be looking at how will sea level rise impact the Delta. Probably the most prominent way that we're seeing it is that there's going to be a change in the salinity in terms of the water from the ocean will make its way, as sea level rises, will make its way inward into the Delta. So as it makes its way inward, that is a water quality threat to any water that gets exported for purposes for drinking water, et cetera. So we're definitely concerned about sea level rise and helping to minimize that saltwater intrusion into the Delta. And then, of course, I noted on the previous slide, fisheries and aquatic species are really important to continued viability and coexistence with that environment and water supply. So declines in fishery populations are key species such as Delta smelt, we are keenly interested in because those are the ones that have a direct nexus back to any potential prohibitions or reductions in ability to move our water through the Delta. And then, of course, subsidence control. It, of course, is important to ensure those islands stay healthy, prosperous with ag districts and reclamation districts along with the community, but also allow for those levees to stay fortified and in place for water supply. So those are some of the challenges that we've been facing for quite some time. And then I'll take you to the next slide. So just to give you a little bit of, there's there is hope with these challenges doesn't mean that there's no way for us to actually implement solutions that make sense for them. So you will see subsidence control, one of the initiatives we're working on today along with others in the Delta as well, includes using rice and wetlands as a way to help with subsidence control. It's anticipated if you institute rice and wetlands now, you could see anywhere from a 7 to 14 foot increase in the land elevation by 2100. That's fairly significant and really does help with the overall stability of the islands and, of course, going back to those levees. Fishery declines. We are not just a water, you know, agency that's utilizing water in the Delta. We are very active with our own set of scientists that are constantly studying and better understanding the fishery species. We have both salmon and Delta smelt experts that are working closely with academia, including UC Davis and other public water agencies and fishery agencies across the U.S. and the state government. So these engagements that we do have prompted us to get into studies of fisheries on our island. So we're actually looking at having fish, and we did do it this past year, the first time ever we supplemented fish onto the island that are of concern, fisheries in particular, looking at Delta smelt. So it was a very successful effort. And the general concept is, can you reintroduce this this specific species, Delta smelt, that is not doing well in the natural environment where they've had a very hard time finding the native fish in the Delta for quite some time? Can you start to supplement it into a natural environment like a Delta island impoundment or a pond, and then reintroduce it back into the freshwater pathway or into the Delta so that it can continue to grow and exist and the population thrive? It was a successful effort. We're very excited about that, and we're partnering heavily with our California and state agencies to advance these efforts. So a lot of support by the fisheries agencies as well. And then flood and seismic risk, sea level rise, really one of the best ways that we can help, you know, combat these two major threats is through the widening and raising of levees. And so we do have several projects we've done over the years where we have not only shored up the levees on the islands we own, but really looking at new ways, technologies, and engineering standards that are above current standards today to ensure that we have long-term viability for the continued passage of our water supply to export out. Next slide. So where do we see the future of these islands and our engagement in the Delta? Specifically, these are the five different, you know, elements of how we're viewing various activities. So various activities are listed in white, and those are either items that are under development today that we're currently studying, or we're even implementing projects and receiving revenue, et cetera, from them. So water supply is everything from that levee modernization. We're also monitoring the amount of water that gets diverted through metering technology. We're looking at if there's still a possibility with the Delta Conveyance Project to do mitigation with these islands and receive revenue back from the state of California. We're looking at ecosystem restoration, floating wetlands, the fish conservation that I mentioned on the previous slide. We're also looking at eco-mitigation banking, which is really big in the Delta right now, where you have a number of investors wanting to generate mitigation land for any project, whether it be flood protection or other water supply-related projects. Fish food production is also a big one for mitigation purposes. And even looking at the voluntary agreements, if there's a way for us to receive money for reduced diversions. For climate adaptation, we're looking at carbon sequestration and subsidence control. We currently have a $20 million grant that we're working to receive from the Delta Conservancy, where we'll be developing one island for those purposes with rice and wetlands. Multi-benefit farming is key. We want to make sure we're not just farming the land and have tenants there that continue to, you know, receive and be prosperous with their crop, but also looking at what kind of crops make the most sense for conservation of water in the Delta and also for multi-benefit purposes. We are looking at solar on the islands and seeing if there's a possibility for our pumping facilities through the reclamation districts to utilize solar to help offset energy costs. And we are, we did partner with Lawrence Livermore Labs to do our carbon capture study and look at how that might be a potential revenue stream into the future. Science includes, of course, the aquatic research noted earlier, looking at resiliency and innovation on site, and also looking at other farming practices. And last but not least, Delta is very much seen under the Delta Reform Act as a place to coexisting with the natural environment in the Delta, along with water and its importance to California water supply, making sure that we're coexisting with the community and their needs. So whether it's looking at the recreational elements, which waterfowl recreation is huge in the Delta, to tribal engagement, small family farms, to everything from nature and bird watching. Next slide. So last year when we came to the board to talk about a major grant to receive, it really prompted a very large discussion by our board about we purchased these islands several years ago, but, you know, what has changed, where are we, and where are we going to go with these islands? So we as staff took a deep dive, and I'll talk about on the next slide, the analysis we did, but the walk away of understanding these islands is that those original areas I just shared with you, you know, they still apply. Those focuses and those reasons for purchasing the islands originally are applicable, with one in particular change. The Delta Conveyance Project is a single tunnel project that does not go underneath the islands as contemplated with California Water Fix, which was a, you know, twin tunnel that would go directly underneath these islands. But all the other things that have been worked on over the years and that we're currently investing in today are literally in play and still applicable. We also see there's a goal to operate these islands with revenue covering the cost and creating revenue opportunities that would not only cover the cost of the islands today, but actually become a revenue stream to the organization of Metropolitan, helping to offset those costs and, of course, do a lot of wonderful things related directly back to water supply and also other multi-benefit purposes, strategic value. And then continuing to do check-ins with our board. The staff is not currently recommending we sell the islands today, but considering options for, you know, what the world looks like before principal payments are due. So right now, we are currently paying interest-only payments on the islands until the year 2041. And so after that, we'll have principal as part of those payments, and, of course, that would be an increase in the cost to own and operate these islands. So we definitely have a longer-term goal or target to ensure not only are we cost recovery, but that we would have revenue that would offset and create an opportunity for the district to offset other costs. Next slide. So now I'd like to pivot and talk a little bit about the Delta Conveyance Project and give you brief updates there, and then we can open it up for questions on both topics or anything else of interest from the board. Next slide. So the Department of Water Resources has been working ever since a year and a half on a new environmental impact report. They officially certified this report in December of 2021, which is a really big milestone on this project. And so what this really means in totality is they've done a thorough evaluation of the different ways and different options you could move water through the Delta as part of the State Water Project. And they analyzed all these alternatives, project alternatives, and they landed on a final project. So now they have an environmental document that analyzes both the impacts associated with constructing this and essentially identifying a final project of 6,000 CFS. And that yellow highlighted line is the alignment of the region that would be where the project would lie. So it would be a 6,000 CFS with 2,000-3,000 CFS intakes in the North Delta. And you can see the dots at the top of the map. And then it would traverse through the eastern delta, so it would avoid the central delta, which is key. So that actually helps minimize environmental impacts associated with the construction and the tunneling activity. And then it would make its way to the Bethany Reservoir and be able to toggle off between providing water through the California Aqueduct through the Bethany Reservoir, and then we would still be able to use the southern forebay for pumping. So this actually creates not only an alternate way to move our water through the Delta as a state water contractor, but also two ways we could receive the water through the California Aqueduct. Right now, we just have the pumping facilities. This would introduce another entry point through the Bethany Reservoir. This is really key. If we have operational outages in the South Delta, if there's maintenance or rehabilitation that needs to be done on those southern pumping facilities, there's now an alternate way. Or let's say there's a catastrophic event that impacts either Bethany Reservoir or the South Delta, you now have an ability to move your water into the California Aqueduct in two different ways. So this is very different than the California Water Fix. So two entry points on the south, and then you have two intakes on the north. This environmental impact report, I cannot emphasize enough how many comments and evaluation that was done by DWR. They received over 700 letters and over 7,000 individual comments on the environmental impact report. The final conclusion was that there were no major changes warranted. However, they did make refinements to the project description, and they ensured that there were a number of things included in that final project description that was key. They also included a settlement agreement between the Contra Costa Water District and the Department of Water Resources, and this essentially is wrapped into the environmental impact report and prevents any further protests or concerns from Contra Costa Water District with this project. So that was also pretty key. It was an early settlement discussion and agreement that was made in advance of all the water rights proceedings, et cetera. Next slide. So most importantly, we just had this major milestone of a final EIR. What happens next with this project? So I'll walk you through the timeline of different events that will be occurring in the coming year or two. Next slide. This is a timeline that's been published by the Department of Water Resources. And you can see on the top in the blue chart is the CEQA and NEPA. So this is the federal and state environmental impact processes. And you can see we have a final EIR that certified at the end of calendar year 2023, and a final environmental impact statement for the federal NEPA document is anticipated for mid-2024. So these are really critical documents in that they're foundational. They allow for the Department of Water Resources to move forward with other key environmental processes like the permit applications with the fishery agencies and the State Water Resources Control Board, along with the Delta Stewardship Council. So they really can't move forward with all those processes without those environmental documents. So pretty important and foundational. So you can see on the second part of this timeline is a massive green, there's massive green bars that are indicating the start in 2023 and into 2024, 25, 26, and 27, these key permitting processes. And so we will start to see more activity. You'll start to see applications going in from the Department of Water Resources to key agencies to further permit this project for operation and eventually construction. Please advance. So if you can click, yeah, perfect. So the current planning funding that Metropolitan has secured for this project, and this is back in fall of 2020, the Metropolitan Board voted to support, and it was a unanimous vote by the board, to support funding for this project or this planning and permitting activities through the end of calendar year 2025. The total share that Metropolitan's paying is $160.8 million for that those years right there, 2021, 22, 23, 24, and 25. What you will note is that there's 2 years, 2026 and 2027, that are not currently planned for funding yet. So it is anticipated now that we have a final impact report, now that the California Department of Water Resources has identified a project, they're working on identifying what would be the project. And go ahead and advance the slide one more time. The project cost. So the project cost estimate is anticipated to come out in 2024. So this is going to be an important year where we're going to learn what the project estimate for the new alignment will be. Right after that, we anticipate a cost-benefit analysis will be published by the state of California. And this is really, really key as this document will analyze the overall cost benefits of this project for the state of California. What you should know is the Metropolitan staff will also do cost-benefit analysis and look at what this project really means to Metropolitan Service Area and its member agencies. What does it help us do in terms of shoring up the wholesale system, the value of the state water project supplies, and how this project would help with additional water supply reliability and, of course, offset any declines in water expected in future years. And then you can see the next funding needed for this project would have to be at the very latest, the end of 2025, that Metropolitan Board would have to contemplate additional planning dollars along with other state water contractors that are participating in the project. We actually have two state water contractors that took to their boards last month, or this month, authorization to continue supporting this project and funding it through end of 2027. So there is momentum and a lot of desire from other state water contractors to ensure this project gets to the finish line so that it can meet construction of 2027. And of course, we will be contemplating similar decision-making back at Metropolitan's board once we get that project cost estimate and cost-benefit analysis, because that's critical to the board making their decision. Next slide. That concludes the updates on two major areas related to the Bay Delta, both the Delta Islands and, of course, Delta Conveyance Project. And I stand ready for any questions that the board may have, and thank you for having me here today.
Well, no, thank you for joining us. Great presentation. I will ask our board if we have any questions. Director Armstrong.
Yeah, just a comment. Thank you very much for the detailed presentation. I think it really highlights the impacts that and the role and level of participation that Metropolitan has in the Delta for the benefit of all the stakeholders there. And it's not just being a landowner, but really the Met's efforts to advance solutions that I think will go into the future for the benefit of everybody. And if I remember right, I think the land that Metropolitan holds in the freshwater pathway, 25% roughly of all the levees in that freshwater pathway are under Metropolitan's ownership, which, you know, is really important to ensuring the integrity of those levees. But I think it was a great presentation and just want to say thank you.
Any other questions? No. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you.
All right. With that, why don't we take about a 10-minute break? We could. We'll look at resuming our meeting. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Good to see you. Thank you. All right. Thank you, everyone. We will go on to item 6B. And Mr. Mawad, are you going to tee this item? Before you do, I just want to share with my fellow board members. As you know, I represent the district on the Hemet-San Jacinto Groundwater Water Master Board, and we do have an item coming before that on the safe yield, and I truly believe I don't make, in larger decisions like this, I don't want to make decisions on my own. I want the district, I feel I'm, like Director Armstrong at Met on big items, I feel I'm representing the district. So I asked Mr. Mawad if he would put together a analysis of what the Water Master advisor is proposing, and then look at what is best for Eastern Municipal Water District. So with that, I will turn it over to Mr. Mawad.
Thank you, President Pauly, members of the board. So as President Pauly mentioned, this has been an ongoing effort at the Water Master for the last couple of years, I would say, where there's been a initiative to look at the long-term sustainable yield of the basin. Through our participation on the technical advisory committee, we've had a number of discussions, not only with the Water Master Advisor, but also with the other participants. As you know, the cities of Hemet and San Jacinto, as well as Lake Hemet, and private pumpers are represented on the technical advisory committee. Through those discussions, this issue has evolved, and I will share with you that there is not consensus at the technical advisory committee as far as adjusting the safe yield at this time. And we're going to have our technical staff, Laura Barraza and Tom Henderson, walk you through the information. But essentially, there does not appear, at least at staff level, the technical advisory level, there does not appear to be consensus or support for an adjustment. We believe there's a technical reason why this item should be deferred until there's additional analysis. So we will give you some of that information today, and then, of course, we'll be working closely with President Pauly for the upcoming Water Master Board meeting. So with that, let's go through the technical information, share with you kind of where we're at, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions. Laura?
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Get this right. Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. As Joe introduced me, I'm Laura Barraza. This is Tom Henderson. And as you may recall, the Water Master Advisor provided a presentation to this board back in October of last year. That presentation provided some of the preliminary information regarding the adjustments to the safe yield and the adjusted base production rates. So the presentation today is in response to your request, President Pauley, to bring back staff's recommendation and insight on this topic, which will include actually the latest information that we've received from the advisor at the TAC meeting held on Monday, February 12th. So I'll be covering the first couple slides on staff engagement and the definition of the safe yield, and then Tom will be taking over the presentation and focusing more on the technical aspects of the evaluation. So I did want to point out that on the third agenda item, this is the Water Master's Advisor's recommendation. This is what we're expecting the advisor to bring forth for consideration at the Water Master Board meeting, which is set for next Monday, as Joe just mentioned. And this is the latest information that he presented to us during the TAC meeting last week. So there's been quite a bit of staff engagement during the process. As you can see from the first bullet under the TAC meeting discussions, this has been a long-standing item for discussion at the quarterly TAC meetings for almost 2 years. So granted, each TAC meeting discussed different aspects of the safe yield evaluation, but as noted, it has been a constant discussion item for quite some time now. Aside from the discussions at the TAC meetings, there's also been a lot of in-person and Teams meetings with the Water Master Advisor, as well as the other public agencies who are part of the stipulated judgment, namely the cities of Hemet, City of San Jacinto, and Lake Hemet Municipal Water District. So in addition, a number of email threads have been shared on the topic, such as the methodology being used, the hydrology being applied, the modeling effort, and discussions on interpreting modeling results, just to name a few. But before we move on from this slide, I did want to emphasize there has been a lot of effort put forth, not only on Eastern staff, but also as well as the other agencies, including the Water Master Advisor. So moving on to the safe yield definition, this is as it's stated in the stipulated judgment. So a couple of items to point out on this slide that are of particular importance. First being the underlying text, which emphasizes the long-term use language in this definition, both from a quantity of supply and also the hydrologic cycle. In essence, the evaluation should be based on long-term hydrology data that then defines the long-term basin yield. So the second point of emphasis is the last sentence on the slide, which states that the initial safe yield estimate was approximately 45,000 acre-feet per year. And this was defined when the stipulated judgment was originally put in place. And you'll see later on in the presentation, the latest modeling efforts and evaluations have provided that these results are actually very close to this initial safe yield estimate of 45,000 acre feet per year. So with that introduction, I'm going to hand off the presentation to Tom and he'll dive into the technical aspects, both the recommendation and our insight.
Good morning, President Pauley, members of the board. I'm going to talk through initially the Water Master's recommendation, Water Master Technical Advisor's recommendation. So I'll be really summarizing what was presented most recently. There was a period up to this point where there were a lot of iterations of looking at different things. So let's see. So an important sort of foundational step in this is that the Water Master Technical Advisor looked at some results that were generated by a consultant using our existing groundwater model. That work was conducted at the direction of the Water Master Technical Advisor. And specifically, there were certain periods that are shown on that slide where the consultant came up with an estimated yield, a basin yield, not a safe yield, but an estimated basin yield. And as Laura pointed out, you can see those numbers are pretty close to the 45,000 acre feet per year. There's nothing in the modeling approach that is problematic or deficient. These are simply numbers that are pulled from the model based on the information that's put into the model. Based on that, there were a variety of ways that the Water Master Technical Advisor looked at the safe yield, and that challenge for the Technical Advisor was to assess all of the waters that are already allocated, committed to others, what the basin yield would be, what the estimate of pumping is. All those components of a water budget needed to be taken into consideration, and in fact, he arrived at two primary numbers that you can see on the slide there, the 42,500 and the 43,100, which are, as you can see, both, A, they're very close to each other. The main difference between those two is the basin yield period that the Water Master Technical Advisor considered. There's some pros and cons in both, and both of these recommendations developed by the Water Master Technical Advisor are one of many methodologies that can be used to estimate the safe yield. This methodology is the one that the Water Master Technical Advisor chose to go with. And specifically, as we iterated through this, we came up with this listing here, and I'll just talk about some of the numbers here. These were the option three presented by the Water Master. And you can see that top number is the 43,100. There's some important numbers here. If you look at the bottom two, the minus 2030 and the minus 4660, that's an effort by the Water Master to quantify water that's already been allocated or spoken for. A very important number in the mix here is the minus 11,830. That's based on the average extractions for the period 2013 through 2022. Again, keeping in mind that if you go back 10 years and look at the reduction in groundwater extraction that the Water Master group as a whole has achieved, that's quite a reduction. One of the outcomes of the stipulated judgment was a need to immediately reduce pumping by 10,000 acre feet per year to address the overdraft that existed at that time, and that was accomplished amongst many accomplishments by the Water Master group. In any case, the bottom line number here is that the adjusted base production rights, according to this calculation, that are available to the parties to the stipulated agreement are 21,630 acre feet per year. That's a reduction from the existing 22,283. It's in the neighborhood of 650 acre feet per year, and I'm going to show that on the next slide. Okay, 653. And so there's a methodology for distribution of the adjusted base production rights. There are certain entities that have some rights that are reserved. In any case, if you do the math, you can see what that net reduction is to each of the agencies, and that they sum up to 653 acre feet per year. Water Master also presented an option to step down that reduction, that 653, over the course of several years. And so you can see that reflected in this table. So talk about some of the staff observations. Laura and I have been heavily involved in this process since May of 2022. As we went through the process, there is the legal aspect of whether or not the safe yield has to be addressed, and I think the Mr. Bunn, the Water Master legal counsel, has advised the Water Master Technical Advisor at what frequency he needs to do this. But as we went through that, there was also the question in our minds from the technical perspective. This is it's based on long-term hydrologic periods. What is an appropriate frequency to address the safe yield? I don't think we've come up with an answer on that yet. But what we did notice is that there were some things that we would like to see that could be improved. Again, many methodologies to estimate the safe yield. We wanted to see some methodologies that included a longer look at the hydrology, both the historic hydrology and then, of course, as you go into future predictive modeling, looking at things like what DWR recommends for the groundwater sustainability program under SGMA. We also felt like there was a need to start looking at separating the native yield from the managed yield. That's a nod towards all of the work that has been done to introduce conjunctive use introduce certain programs like recycled water in lieu, but separating out and understanding better the native yield from the managed yield or operational yield. A big one that hasn't been quantified is model margin of error that we would like to see. In modeling circles, we talk about uncertainty. So if we estimated pumping was 12,000 acre feet per year, okay, what's the uncertainty in that number? Is it actually 11,000 to 13,000? As you compound all those water budget components together, you come up with an uncertainty which could impact that safe yield estimate. And then as we went through this process, we did see a overestimation of private pumper extractions in the data set that was used and originally presented by the Water Master. We took a hard look at that, and there's a list of four sub-bullets there that are pretty important. And again, it's a proof of the good work that Eastern and the other parties have done, things like the offset of recycled water users, recycle water in lieu of groundwater extraction, the North San Jacinto initiative, and then, of course, the natural conversion of ag land to residential land. I'll just give a graphic on that. This is very telling. You can see the black solid line are the annual connections and EDUs. We all know what happened in the 2008-2009 time frame, but you could see that black line shallow out and remain much flatter than it was from 04 to 09. That's basically, but the 04 to the 09 period is where all the action occurred. That's where there was a lot of residential conversion of ag land to residences. If you look at the blue bars, you can see that was the net groundwater production, very high compared to today's production. And so those were things that were pretty important that we wanted to accurately represent in this analysis. And the Water Master Technical Advisor worked with us on those. And that's how he came up with the 2013 to 2022 average of 11,830 acre feet per year. So we have some recommendations for next steps. One key thing is a holistic basin-wide approach. We tend with the Water Master to focus on the adjudicated area, which is appropriate. But that area is part of the larger groundwater basin as a whole. DWR requires us as the Groundwater Sustainability Agency for the San Jacinto Groundwater Basin to address groundwater sustainability basin-wide. The Water Master has the authority to implement programs to ensure sustainability, but looking at that program holistically is really our obligation. We have been collaborating and want to continue to collaborate with the TAC committee to come up with a safe yield methodology that works for everyone, is technically defensible, credible, and is consensus-based. We would like to arrive at a point where whatever the answer to the question is, whatever the numbers are that come out, there isn't controversy associated with it because we get buy-in along the way. That's the goal there. Methodology should include some things that maybe weren't as robust in what we saw up to this point. We do want to look at long-term hydrology. We do want to look at historic wet-dry cycles. We do want to characterize those. We do want to look at the separation of the native and managed yield, as I mentioned earlier. We also want to give credit where credit's due, all the Water Master activities where we've introduced water into the basin to either address the historic overdraft or to make the basin conditions more robust. We want those integrated in there. We also want to address the uncertainty in the output and how that relates to the safe yield. So these are all aspirational things that we see coming in the future. And one thing that becomes a policy consideration is what is the Water Master Technical Advisor's true obligations with respect to a number that is calculated that is very close to the existing number. So there are some things to be covered in the coming months. And so these are all things that we've talked about on a technical basis and have advocated for. And that is the end of the presentation.
Thank you, Tom and Laura. Appreciate the presentation. I just wanted to add a few things. I think since the establishment of the Water Master over the past decade, it's been an incredible success as far as the collaboration with the other participants, with the cities and Lake Hemet and the private pumpers. In fact, over the past decade, collectively, WaterMaster participants have invested over $43 million to purchase replenishment water. On average, as you know, 7,500 acre-feet per year. That's a $43 million investment that has occurred over the past decade. In addition, collectively, the participants have invested over $25 million in infrastructure improvements to be able to divert river flows and to be able to replenish the groundwater basin. So these efforts that have been undertaken over the past decade have resulted in a more stable groundwater basin. I think we need to acknowledge the success that the WaterMaster participants have achieved. You know, our role has also been, frankly, on this particular issue to try to build consensus moving forward. And we've put forward various alternatives to the participants as well as to the advisor, trying to build consensus. And again, unfortunately, there does not appear to be consensus at the technical advisory committee level. Having said that, we wanted to bring this item forward, make you aware of what the issue is, knowing that there's going to be a discussion and a potential vote next week at the WaterMaster Advisor, make sure that President Pauly has feedback from the rest of the board. But frankly, you know, what we are going to suggest to President Pauly is that if there does not appear to be consensus at the board level, that perhaps there's an opportunity for a substitute motion. And given the technical issues that Tom and Laura brought up, given the fact that there appears to be a significant reduction in agricultural pumping that we've observed, we don't believe that's coming back, and that needs to be captured appropriately. And given the fact that the technical advisor has put together a recommendation of a revised safe yield that's essentially within 4% of the existing safe yield, meaning that's within the level of accuracy of groundwater modeling. All those technical reasons, and again, we're focused on the technical merits of this recommendation, nothing else. We don't believe it's appropriate at this time for us to recommend an adjustment. And I think there may be an opportunity to receive on file this information and for the WaterMaster Board to direct staff to work with the Technical Advisory Committee to come up with a more sound and robust technical basis for any future adjustment. With that, myself, I know Linnea has been very much involved with this, as well as Laura and Tom are here to answer any questions, but I also think this is an opportunity for you to provide feedback to President Pauly.
Director Slauson.
So Woodward and Curran did the study.
Yes. The groundwater modeling, correct.
And they didn't take into consideration ag conversion or increased use of recycled?
You know, that's a great question, Director Slauson. They did, but the data set is different than what we are recommending. If I can go back to the graph that Tom shared. So you'll see there's a dramatic growth in terms of new EDUs connected, that's that solid black line that starts in 05, 06 timeframe. Our recommendation was to take the 2009 to the latest information, 2022, as far as ag production, and we felt that was the appropriate data set. I believe the WaterMaster Advisor in Wood and Kern took the 2013 timeframe to 2022. So that difference of data set, what you use, makes a difference in terms of the resultant impact on the public agencies. And we put forward that option to the advisor, and you know, he feels strongly that it should be 2013 versus 2009. So it is a technical issue. It really is. But beyond that, there's other matters that Tom presented. So we have, and I will underscore this point, we as Eastern, we've tried very hard to frankly build consensus. And I think if you check with the other agencies, that's been our role. It's been very positively received by the other agencies. It's just, I think, for a number of reasons, the advisor feels strongly about the approach that he's put forward. And again, I don't want the WaterMaster Board electeds to feel that they're put in an awkward position here. That's why I think there's an opportunity potentially to coalesce around a substitute approach.
So, but we feel that the variables that we're using are the most appropriate.
Yes, we believe there is a better technical approach, that the technical and the data set that's been used so far is not appropriate, and we think there are revisions. And Tom, if you want to step up and clarify that.
Just
Just one important point. The information that's derived from the model is inherently correct. There's no error by a modeling team or by a consultant. It's how those data are applied. This is a great example where we felt that the most appropriate way to look at the groundwater extraction was really from 2009 through 2022. Water Master Technical Advisor felt, based on confidence in the data set and the stipulated judgment, that 2013 to 2022 was better. You can see that makes a couple of hundred acre feet per year difference. And that's just one methodology difference. And the goal, at least in my mind, that Joe's mentioned is if we can get with TAC to a place where we can build consensus on a methodology. Models aren't right or wrong. They take the data we put into them. We pull data out of them, and then we make decisions based on those data. But if we can come up with a consensus-based approach to this, then ideally we can eliminate some of the controversy.
Okay. Director Armstrong.
Well, I wasn't here in October when the Water Master made the presentation, but are the levels in the groundwater basin declining?
You know, they were when we started. Tom, do you want to elaborate? I think there's, yeah.
So, and I apologize, Director Armstrong, for a complicated answer, but it depends on where you are.
Okay.
And so it's a mixed bag. One of the things is we have a mixture now of man-made activities with natural activities. Aquifers have a memory, which I know doesn't sound real intuitive, but seeing how that those natural conditions interact with the man-made conditions is one of our problems. It's a bit of a handicap. And so we're going to try to dissect those, separate them, understand what happens with natural conditions. I talked about giving credit for all the good work we've done. I know things would be worse were it not for the activities we've done. Some of the members of the TAC have said, hey, my groundwater levels are stable, and that's true in that particular area. Other places you can see declines. Other places, Moreno Valley, you see water levels going up. It's a full system that responds holistically, and in any one point it may look one way. I don't know if that helps.
Okay.
If I could just add just a little bit, if you look at the trends over the time since the Water Master has been established, there was a very steep decline in the groundwater levels. Once the Water Master was formed, that decline evened out, and now if you look at the last several years, it's actually stabilized. And so as we talked about this, one of the main goals of the stipulated judgment was to eliminate the overdraft condition. And there are indicators that potentially that has been accomplished, which again is another reason why we feel that potentially an adjustment to the safe yield at this time is premature, that there's still a lot more long-term data that should be collected and be able, again, to take advantage and really understand the true impacts of the Water Master activities.
Well, that was helpful. And then just one other question is, are the private pumpers, is it metered?
There are instances where we estimate. There was a recent study with RACAC, I believe it is, Western Riverside County Agricultural Coalition, where there was properties that weren't metered, where we looked at crop type, potential evapotranspiration to come up with an estimate. But our groundwater monitoring program, where we lead the charge at Eastern, we actually visit many meters throughout the basin, and we maintain those meters, replace those meters, and we get readings. And so groundwater extraction is one component of the water budget. There's also rainfall, mountain front recharge, but we do have a robust groundwater extraction monitoring program.
Okay. Well, I support staff's recommendation. I really think that our efforts in the managed part of it, you know, really is important to incorporate correctly.
Thank you, Dr. Armstrong.
Yeah, I had a question. On the when you talk about private pumpers, do you count as private wells that are privately owned but utilized by Lake Hemet? Are they still considered private wells, or are those considered
public entities? When you say utilized by Lake Hemet, meaning?
Well, I know of I know of somebody who's got a private well, and Lake Hemet is buying water from them.
So I have not seen an instance where we were aware of that transfer that you just mentioned. From our perspective, if Farmer X pulls out 1,000 acre feet, what he does with that water, who he sells it to, we don't try to account for that.
Okay.
But we do get an inventory from all the parties. They send us very actively, here's a summary of our pumping. And we have some joint projects like IRRP where we have to understand the various parties' contribution to the programs.
So, no, I just, again, wanted to bring this for the board. I think that there's going to be some contention at the meeting on Monday. I think I truly believe that we're here as an agency, and I look at our expert and staff recommendation on what is going to be best for Eastern. So I will look for Joe and staff to come up with some substitute language that I think we can build a consensus on. Any final thoughts, Joe?
No. I think you summarized it well, President Pauly. Again, we'll be attending the Water Master Board meeting and supporting President Pauly accordingly. But we believe we have the technical foundation for the position that we have taken.
And we'll have our staff members at the meeting?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Very good.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. Go ahead.
If I could add, I agree with staff's recommendation. I think if it's been stabilized and maybe even improving. And a former late board member once told me some great technical advice. He said, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So I'm sticking with that. If it's working.
I will take that into deep consideration to.
Push that into the administrative
code if it's not broken. Anyway, thank you again. I do appreciate very much the work you two have put into this and all of staff. So thank you for that. We'll move on to item 7, which is to receive and file various reports. I'll make a motion to do so. So you'd like to second it. Director Armstrong, may I get a roll call vote, please?
President Pauly?
Aye.
Director Cronin?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Armstrong?
Aye.
And that passes 4-0. Director Record absent. That brings us to our calendar review. Good morning.
Good morning, President Pauly, members of the board. This morning, I have two events for your consideration and review. Beginning with the first event is scheduled for Wednesday, April 10th, and that is the Association of California Water Agencies Legislative Symposium, and it's taking place in Sacramento. And the second event is the California Water Efficiency Partnership, CalWEP, peer-to-peer flagship event. Scheduled for Wednesday, May 29th through Thursday, May 30th, and is taking place in San Jose. Flyers with further information and details for these events are included within your packets. Turning to page 2, you will find the current listing for the Board Members Master Calendar for the next 2 weeks. If you could please review the information and let me know if there's any needed changes or updates. Top of page 3, you will find the list of upcoming events with participants. The first event is the Aqua DC 2024 Annual Conference, Tuesday, February 25th through Thursday, February 29th. On Saturday, March 2nd, is the French Valley Community Fair. Monday, March 10th through Wednesday, March 13th, is the Water Reuse 2024 Symposium. And lastly, Tuesday, March 19th, is the Sacramento Lobby Day. Continuing on page 3, you'll find the board meetings through the month of May, and all are on schedule. Page 4 is the list of upcoming committee meetings, and again, all of these are on schedule. Turning to page 5 is the joint interagency meetings. I do want to make a point that, or note that the March 5th Elsinore Valley meeting has been pushed to start time of 4 p.m. Other than that, all others are on schedule. As for the out-of-office schedules, we do have two board members that will be out of the area April 2nd through April 5th. One board member will be out of the office, and on May 17th through June 3rd, another board member will be out of the office. This concludes my calendar review. Are there any questions or comments?
Questions?
Yes.
No, I have no questions. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Great job
as usual. Appreciate it. That we will go to a director's attendance reports, and we will start with Director Armstrong.
Okay. I wanted to first just follow up on what our general manager mentioned in his report. The April 11th, I think, is when we're going to do our Pure Water tour. And, I mean, I would hope that maybe some of our board members here also would be interested in joining us in that. I think it's going to be an important topic. And I know I've heard from board members and staff in our region that are not quite fully understanding accurately and relying on misinformation. And so I think it's an opportunity to get all the facts so that you're aware of it as it moves forward, because it would be a very, very big project if it moves forward. Standing committees and the board, we had an information item at MET related to the development of a supplemental water management program, and I believe Eastern staff probably participated in that, but it's an effort MET put forth, meeting with groundwater agencies in the MET service area to develop a future groundwater supplemental water program when there's surplus water. And it was just informational, but essentially agencies would be able to buy water when there's some surplus, store, buy it at the full rate, store it, and then when they take it out within the next 10 years, they would get a credit, some offset that would be equal to some avoided costs for Metropolitan. So it would sort of be another program to augment the cyclic storage program, wouldn't replace the cyclic storage program. But I know there were a lot of groundwater agencies that were interested in taking supplemental water, but the economics of it doesn't necessarily make sense for them. So hopefully this is something that more agencies would want to participate in. The board at MET did approve the wave attenuators at Diamond Valley Lake. So that's a big help to the recreation and the boats and stuff at the lake. So that was a good event. And then we had our first review of the budget and the rate workshop. And I want to thank our staff for getting me information and helping me digest all of that. But big highlight would be that MET's sales are continuing to decline, and they're budgeting somewhere around 1.4 million acre feet in their next budget. The current budget's somewhere around 1.5, so that decrease creates a problem. Currently, the projection for this year is 1.25 or somewhere around there, so it's still not even at that level. But MET's rate structure is sort of flipped. You know, you have all these fixed costs, but all of those costs are recovered in the rate, the variable rate. So when the demand goes down, Metropolitan doesn't have the revenues to recover to offset the costs, so they need to raise rates. So their projection was 21% over the next 2 years, a 13%, an 8% increase. But they are looking for alternatives to help mitigate that, and one of those is to rely on the ad valorem assessments, and in fact to double the amount of the ad valorem assessments that are currently in place. And I feel really good about them exploring that alternative. We've, for the last year and a half or so, we have expressed support and asked them to look at that further. We've done that in meetings. We've done that in letters that we have sent. We've done that on the side in conversations. And it's, I don't know who's read Harry Potter books, but it's the ad valorems are the Voldemort. You don't say it. You don't even say that. It's the name that you don't even mention. But now people are talking about it at Metropolitan and going so far as to even really considering making an adjustment to it. And there was a lot of comments on that and a lot of maybe, I would say, I haven't been there in the past, but I would say maybe more support for that concept. And
So if that was to, if that was to happen, it would reduce the rate increase from 13 next year to around 7. So we're hoping that's something that, that the full board could support. And so that's but it's going to be a challenge, and it's going to be a challenge a couple more years ahead too with the rates at Metropolitan. It's my update.
Thank you for that, and thank you for getting in today's Harry Potter reference. Director Corona.
Okay, I attended the Rancho California Water District meeting on February 8th. Kind of uneventful other than public comment, and there was a disgruntled ratepayer that spoke out about some meters that were installed improperly, and the they came out later, corrected the situation, but there was just monstrous bills out to be paid, and so the disgruntled ratepayer was me.
I was going to say, and, did the disgruntled ratepayer have a name?
It happened to be me. And so I actually asked for them. There has been no discussion about this item in an open session, so I asked that they agendize that item and talk about it. Haven't done it yet, but we'll see what happens. And then had my pre-LAFCO meeting with Pakal and Nick, and that was a good meeting. The big item on the agenda this week is a increase in the sphere of influence for the city of Coachella. There is a possible competing request by the city of Indio, which is not mature yet, so we will be considering the Coachella application tomorrow, and we'll see if there's any fireworks. So that's all I have.
All right, thank you. I attended the Winchester Municipal Advisory Committee meeting. There was a fantastic guest speaker this past meeting, our own Joe Mawad. There is a lot going on in Winchester. If you haven't looked at the map, the development is booming. And so there's a lot of questions. I thought it was an excellent meeting. Joe did, as usual, a fantastic job. But a lot of questions, a lot of interest in what our infrastructure, what our costs and things going forward are. And in addition to that, I know Nick had a meeting with some residents from the downtown Winchester core that's looking to potentially put sewer in there and making sure that they understand our process for doing that and different financing options. If that's a route they want to take, that we are more than happy to help them with that, but that's a decision them and their fellow landowners, if they want to tax themselves to put sewer in, again, we're more than happy to help. So Nick clarified some of that, but a lot going on in Winchester. I do thank Joe for attending that. Had a good bi-monthly meeting with Laura on various parts of our consumer end of our business here, so appreciate that very much. Is it for me, Director Slauson?
Yes, attended SAPA Commission meeting yesterday, and most significantly is we approved a $240,000 budget to provide for irrigation replacement and landscape refreshment around the building, the administrative building.
All right, very good. Do we have any director's comments or future agenda items? Director Armstrong?
Yeah, just want to follow up on the director's comments on Director Corona. You know, I think it's you've seen in the past where you put in a new utility billing system and it's not right, and some person in a senior community gets a $100,000 bill or you know, these mistakes and these errors. And so I appreciate the effort that we've done at Eastern to ensure before we go live with something that it's accurate and we're billing our customers properly. I know these things happen, but I also appreciate that I know that if it happened here, we would be transparent about it and bring it forward to our board to talk about it. But the best thing is that it doesn't happen. So I just want to, that's just a reminder of how important those things are.
I'll echo in on that because you bring up a very good point. There was an issue and it was not resolved. And I occasionally we have people come to our board meeting and we're always welcome the public to come. But we don't have a line out the door of disgruntled customers because before it gets that, we have a fantastic organization here that takes care of all these issues, and we are transparent, and we do the right thing. I think that comes from both the board, the senior management. I would be distressed if we had someone standing here saying, I have this issue and no one's paying attention to it. So I would like to echo those comments.
And one last thing, if you'd like to listen to the audio, it's available on Rancho's site.
Any other closing thoughts?
Nope.
We do not have a need for closed session. Is that correct?
That's correct. Sure.
Very good. With that, we will stand adjourned until Wednesday, May 6th at 9 a.m.
Thank you.
Sonia.